From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On Monday, Fresh Air joins National Public Radio's special coverage of the war in the Gulf. Today's edition of Fresh Air features interviews from our archives. Coming up, J.L. Chestnut on being the first black lawyer in Selma, Alabama. When Selma became a focal point of the civil rights movement, he had to choose between the movement's civil disobedience tactics and an attorney's respect for the law. Also, actor Keith Carradine talks about life in a family of actors. And we have some thoughts on family from poet Sharon Olds. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Defense officials continue to be cautious about the prospects for an early end to the Gulf War, despite what appears to be substantial early success. Defense Secretary Dick Cheney warned that the war could last a considerable time. NPR's David Malpas has more from the Pentagon.
A senior Pentagon official says the U.S. has not lost any additional aircraft or pilots today. One American was killed yesterday when his F-15 was shot down. The Pentagon source says B-52 bombers are playing a big role in the round-the-clock attacks, and U.S. ground forces are on the move, perhaps preparing for an early ground assault or merely moving to unnerve and confuse Iraqi troops in Kuwait. Some targets not destroyed yesterday are being revisited. Officials say the Scud missile still poses some risk, and the Iraqi Air Force may be hiding out. Officials say no one should assume this will be short or easy, despite all the apparent success so far. The Pentagon is still assessing damage to Iraq. Tomorrow, the military is expected to release the first pictures of the bombardment taken by cameras on board the U.S. warplanes. I'm David Malpas at the Pentagon.
Something of a pessimistic assessment about some of the effectiveness of the Allied military attack on Iraq has come from Israel. NPR's John Hockenberry reports from Jerusalem that after a day of optimism, the details emerging from intelligence data reveal that much of the Iraqi threat to Israel still exists.
At a military briefing in Tel Aviv this evening, the chief military spokesman of Israel, General Nachman Shai, told reporters that a state of emergency remains in effect tonight and tomorrow in Israel. That includes a full curfew in the Israeli-occupied territories. General Shai said that while, as he put it, much damage was done to Iraqi missile emplacements, the U.S. failed, he said, to eliminate the threat of an Iraqi missile attack.
Understanding is that the mobile missiles are still there, and so we may expect them to launch them, I don't know how many, either tonight, tomorrow, or even the day after. It depends very much what will happen.
There is no indication of when this state of emergency in Israel might end, but when asked whether the Israeli military might act to take out on its own a persistent Iraqi missile threat, General Shai said today he, quote, was in no hurry to get involved in this war. This is John Hockenberry in Jerusalem.
Stringent new anti-terrorism measures are being imposed at many of the nation's airports. In New York, airport security officials said that some parking areas have been closed for safety reasons. Curbside baggage check-ins have been eliminated, and only passengers with tickets were allowed into the terminal gate areas. The airport restrictions were ordered by the Federal Aviation Administration under so-called Level 4 security measures. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 115 points to close at 2,623.51. This is NPR. Authorities in Germany have reported attacks on facilities that are owned by or associated with Americans. Windows were smashed at an American culture center in North Germany, and police in Bonn said they suspected arson in a fire at a U.S.-owned Woolworth store. The U.S. military closed its schools in Germany. Intense security measures have been imposed at German airports and other places thought to be likely targets for Iraqi-inspired reprisals. According to the latest count, Allied warplanes have flown more than 1,200 sorties against Iraqi targets. Officials say that the pace of the assault has intensified again with the coming of darkness, so the real figure may be far higher. The planes, including giant B-52 bombers, have been hitting command and control centers, radar and communications installations, and supply depots. A senior Pentagon official said the planes have been revisiting targets that were missed the first time around. In Cyprus, veteran reporter Jim Muir has been monitoring reports of damage from the area.
Most of the key targets seem to have been outside Baghdad itself, some on the fringes, but a lot more scattered around the countryside. So there are obviously a whole lot of targets that people in Baghdad will simply be unaware of, some of them perhaps even hundreds of miles away. I would say also from experience in Beirut, seeing the Israelis bombing, when you see bombing going on, it looks like the whole world is being destroyed. But once the dust has settled, often the actual damage that turns out to have been done is a lot less catastrophic than it appears when the dust is in the air.
Reporter Jim Muir in Nicosia. The Pentagon today asked civilian blood banks to quadruple the amount of blood they're shipping to the Persian Gulf. Officials for the American Red Cross and the American Association of Blood Banks said they expect to have no problem meeting the need. The two organizations had each been providing 1,000 units of blood per week. Defense officials have asked them to boost that to 4,000 units each by Saturday. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today's program features interviews from the Fresh Air archives. Beginning Monday, Fresh Air will join National Public Radio's special coverage of the war in the Gulf. NPR's war coverage today is preempting Fresh Air on many stations, which is why we're presenting this archival program. Our first interview today is with J.L. Chestnut. In 1958, Chestnut became Selma's first and only black lawyer. In the 1960s, he worked with the NAACP in Selma, Alabama, defending activists. And since then, he's been involved in what he describes as the longer march, turning the victories of the civil rights movement into grassroots change. He founded a law firm in Selma that is now the largest black law firm in Alabama. Chestnut wrote an autobiography called Black in Selma, co-authored with Julia Cass, a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. I spoke with J.L. Chestnut last summer, and he told me that to help him get ahead in the world, his mother had him use a cream to lighten his skin.
I never agreed with that. I went along. My mother's a very strong woman, and she felt that black people could not help anybody. They needed all the help they could get in Selma in the South when I was growing up in the 40s. And so she cultivated white people, and she noticed and told me that if you look about you, all of the prominent black people are light-skinned. The postman, the doctor, the better-known preachers, those who pass at the larger churches. And so she would use this skin lightening as to help her only child get ahead. That is the way she saw things. I never really believed in it, but she's such a strong woman, you go along with her.
What was in the cream, by the way, do you know?
I don't know, but it worked because I'm brown and I turned kind of reddish to her absolute delight.
So it really changed the color of your skin?
It really did.
Huh. Do you regret that?
Well, I think it makes you think about a nation that would cause people to develop so much self-hatred that you could really have a product on the market commercially successful to try and change one's appearance. And then I'm really sad that my mother would have to stoop to that to try to, in her view, to get her son ahead in the land of the free and the home of the brave.
Mm-hmm. You went to law school at Howard University, and then you returned to Selma, Alabama. When you returned to Selma as a lawyer, what kind of cases did you get? Being the first black lawyer in Selma.
Yeah, let me give you some flavor of what was going on there. There were only 150 blacks registered to vote out of a pool of about 15,000. Not one in the entire state of Alabama had ever served on a jury. No blacks had jobs downtown except as delivery people or janitors. And a black person could literally lose his or her life for not yielding a sidewalk or saying sir or ma'am to a white person. Fear was everywhere. It engulfed Selma and it engulfed the South. Now, that is the Selma, the South that I went back to practice law. And the white lawyers there were not only the rulers of the town, they were sophisticated, the country club sophisticates and all of that. They didn't associate with ordinary white people. And they certainly didn't want any parts of some black coming in talking about he was a lawyer in the Dallas County Bar Association. Selma is the county seat of Dallas. promptly passed a resolution and took it to each bank and asking the banks not to lend me any money so that I could open an office. And I had no intentions of trying to borrow any money in any event because I didn't have any collateral. But everybody was hostile, the judge, the officers of the court, the jury, because these seemed to be the same white males all serving in every case. And I had to ask myself many, many times whether or not my client really would be better off with a white lawyer, one who didn't know anything, didn't know as much as I did.
You make an interesting point in your book. You say that, we know when you started as a lawyer, there was no Voting Rights Act, there was no Civil Rights Act. So a lot of injustices couldn't be taken to court.
What we hoped to do was to make new law. We didn't expect to win at that level. The NAACP at that point were financing a lot of criminal cases which were pregnant with the possibility of establishing some of the laws we have on the books now, the Miranda thing where the police have to read you your rights and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And the South was fertile territory for that because just being black in the South made one vulnerable to the police and all of their excesses. And many of them were untrained and in their relationships with black, unrestrained. So we were trying to get cases to the United States Supreme Court that would deal with the whether a confession was voluntary. Eventually we did and changed the law on that subject. A lot of things which are now the law came about through some of our efforts and the court, just with the passage of time, got where we were trying to push them way back in, 1958, 1960.
You said that you didn't feel completely part of the black world as a lawyer in Selma, and that you felt alienated from the gossip and endless conversations about sex and women, and that nobody really wanted to organize or take action.
Well, that's right, but you have to remember, in the Selma of that day, it could easily cost you your life. Many people were killed for talking politics or talking about changing the social order. When I went back to Selma, I didn't expect to become a part of the white world. I had no intentions or desire to become a part of that world. What I didn't anticipate is that I wouldn't be quite a part of the black world either. Now, these were my friends. I went to school with them. I was born there in Selma. They loved to kid around with me, but it was a kind of superficial. It was something phony about it because everybody was scared to death that I would bring up something about voting or about the law. And black people had to be very careful because you never knew what black would go back downtown and tell white people of power that this black said that or said that. And so people were very nervous around me. And a lot of times I'd come in a place and all conversation would stop or some people would get up and leave. And there I was isolated, alone, in a little town of 20,000, 28,000 people, the town in which I was born.
Were people worried also that because you were a lawyer and a representative of the law that you might not turn someone in exactly, but that maybe you'd inform on someone or report on someone? Was there that fear, too?
No, it wasn't that. My reputation in Selma was clear that I had been fighting the police almost literally since I was 7 years old. They knew there was no way I would turn anybody into the police. I might turn the police into somebody.
What was your reaction as a, quote, local when Martin Luther King came to organize in Selma in 1965?
Well, I had been somewhat ambivalent about all of the civil rights leaders. I felt that what they were saying was directed more at the masses than at me. After all, I had 2 degrees, too, and I was educated. And Martin had views which ran counter to everything I'd learned in law school. For an example, he insisted that he had a high moral right to disobey an unjust law. And he would make the determination when the law was unjust. That is not what I learned in law school. That wasn't what I believed in. I felt that you go to court to get a law declared unconstitutional. I wasn't quite sure about all this unjust business. That's not the terminology that lawyers use. In addition to that, Martin was always trying to get me to give up my weapon and calling me a man of little faith. And I was telling him that you go ahead and preach to the masses, but I'm not paying you any attention. I'm going to keep my weapon because it can bark here and bite way down the street. And Martin would laugh. But I knew that his presence in Selma meant that more people like my mother, middle-class blacks, would become involved. That Martin's presence gave a legitimacy to the movement that it otherwise would not have. Also, as long as he was involved, important and powerful white people in Washington would be watching. So he meant everything to the movement.
Did you ever get more comfortable with civil disobedience as a tactic for civil rights?
I was finally convinced that Martin was correct and the people who were paying me were incorrect. It is not generally known, but you take Bloody Sunday. That started out of a situation where a young man, Jimmie Lee Jackson, was shot dead by a state trooper. People were so frustrated and all that, they came up with the grotesque idea of just taking Jimmie's body and marching 50 miles to Montgomery and putting the body on George Wallace's desk. And, of course, that was not done, but it was agreed to make the march to Montgomery. Martin was not involved in that first march, but he came on, I think, the day following in that march. But what is not generally known is while they were putting the people in the streets, they were not paying for that. The NAACP Legal Defense Fund in New York was financing that, and they were a legalistic organization. That's who I worked for. Their view was that you take two or three obviously qualified people, send them down to get registered, and when they are turned down, you go into court, you got a perfect case. Martin was repudiating all that by sending 500 people down because he said he wanted to win in the court of public opinion. He was not interested just in adding a few more votes to the voting rolls in Selma. So I eventually came around to the point of view that he was correct and my bosses were not.
Well, Bloody Sunday on March 7th, 1965, happened during a march from Selma to Montgomery to petition George Wallace for the right to vote. The march was broken up violently by state troopers. Would you share some of your memories of that day?
Well, I had come over from Mississippi, and I wasn't sure that there would be a march. Martin was in Atlanta preaching at his father's church, and some people in Martin's organization did not think well of a march. They didn't think it was worth risking Martin. But I think Andy Young called him in Atlanta and persuaded him that there would be a march with or without him. And Martin then okayed the march. I had gone across the river earlier, across the bridge, because they would not let lawyers march. You know, you had enough foot soldiers. What we didn't have was enough lawyers. It didn't make sense to have lawyers in jail. So I had gone across the river earlier, not knowing whether there would be a march, and to get to a telephone, because once a march started, you would have the FBI, the press, and everybody fighting over the one telephone. So I went over there early to tie it up in case there would be a march. And I'd have to describe to the NAACP what was happening because they were paying the bill. And I was over there tying up the telephone, and I looked up toward the bridge, and there was John Lewis, who's now Congressman John Lewis from Georgia, Atlanta. And this group of marchers coming toward this great line of state troopers and possemen. And I began to describe the scene over the telephone to New York. And then John and the group came face to face with the troopers. And I heard some voice, a state trooper, who said that, stop, this will be as far as you will be permitted to go. Turn around and go back to your churches. And then John and the others began to kneel and pray. And then I heard something that sounded like a tear gas canister hit the pavement. And then there was smoke, bedlam, confusion, blood, tears, cries, and there were these big, hefty possumen swinging billy clubs the size of baseball bats and coming down across the heads of women and children. My eyes were hurting, my head was hurting, and New York was screaming over the telephone, "What's going on? What's going on?" And I tried to pull some women back out of the street, and it was just awful. It was one of the lowest days of my life. At that day, I lost all faith in America. I lost all faith in white people. I said, "My God, black people will never be citizens. We will never be what we ought to be in this land. And what is this? I have gone to Howard University. I'm a lawyer, an officer in the white man's court. And here these people are trampling on my folk in the streets, blood everywhere. And they're trampling on the Constitution, and nobody does anything about it because these people are black." And I was just almost in tears. And 2 days later, I had to revise and make a new assessment because white people and black people came from all over this nation that watched it on television, and they were thoroughly upset at what they saw. You know, it's easy to send a check down from New York and say, "I'm with you." It's something altogether different to come down and lock hands with a black person and say, "I'm ready to go to jail. I'm ready to die if necessary." And I saw hundreds and hundreds of people come from all over this land to join with us in this little town of my birth. And I had to look and reassess all over again. And my faith in this nation, my faith in the human race was restored.
We're listening to an interview with lawyer J.L. Chestnut. Today's edition of Fresh Air features interviews from our archives. Beginning Monday, Fresh Air will be part of NPR's special programming on the war in the Gulf. More with J.L. Chestnut after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guest is J.L. Chestnut, and in 1958 he became the first black lawyer in Selma, Alabama. He's written an autobiography called Black in Selma, Politics and Power in a Small American Town. When the Voting Rights Act was actually passed, what were the immediate effects in Selma?
The immediate effect was that within a six-week span, we went from about 200 registered voters to 9,000. I don't know whether there has been a leap of such proportions in the history of the human race. People who could not vote had no voice in their government in a matter of 6 weeks, became very important players. It is somewhat reminiscent of what has just transpired in Eastern Europe. But we saw immediate impact of that in the courtroom. Blacks began to show up on juries. White politicians had to temper what they said about blacks. And some blacks began to feel that they could run for office. Where there had been hopelessness, we now had hope. Where we felt, I certainly felt, that all we could really hope for was to make some adjustments around the edges in the economic sphere, or maybe get enough votes to get the white policeman out of Black Summer. I saw now that we could do much more than that, that blacks could really sit on governments and pass laws that affected both black and white people. America began to develop some meaning for me.
I'd like to get back now to something you said earlier when we were talking about Martin Luther King. You said that one of the things he wanted you to do was to give up your weapon.
Yes.
And that you were unwilling to do that. It was a gun.
That's right.
You write that you actually gave up your gun the night Martin Luther King was assassinated.
I did. I threw it in a river.
Oh, why?
Well, that was my deep feeling over Martin. I stayed down there on that river under the same bridge, the Edmund Pettus Bridge, crying for about 30 minutes and reflected on it, that my carrying a weapon certainly had not saved Martin. It didn't save Jimmie Lee Jackson. I couldn't think of anything it had done for me, really. And I'd seen John Lewis stare down a whole regiment of state troopers and sheriffs, and he had no weapon. And the things that had been brought about, the changes that had occurred in Selma in the South, had not come at the end of any gun. Says a tribute to my friend who'd given his life in Memphis. I threw it away and watched it sink in the river, and I felt better.
Had you ever used it? What did you want it to do for you when you had the gun?
Oh, just for self-protection. I was not going to attack anybody, but if they came to get me, I would be ready. You know, Martin Luther King was preoccupied with death, foreboding all the time, and he said more than once that they're going to come for us, each one of us, and we won't be back. And I believed him. But the only difference is I had a weapon and I had intended to take some with me.
Now that your memoir is completed, your autobiography, and you can see your life compressed between the covers of a book, has it led you to think about anything that you haven't thought about before or see your life in a different context than you'd seen it before?
Well, when you are battling and going from one war to the next, so to speak, you really don't have any sense of the whole. And this book has caused me to see the many, many barriers that have fallen in the last 30 years that I had never really given any thought to. I am really astounded at the progress we have made, but I'm even more astounded at the progress we haven't made. It's like talking to white people in Selma who are always telling me, said, look how far you've come. In no time at all. And I'm always saying, that's true, but look how far we have to go. I guess it's the old argument about whether the glass is half full or half empty with water. And it depends on your vantage point. But I've had a chance to view for the first time because of this book. I've had a chance to look back over 30 years. And I'm not displeased with what I see.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
J.L. Chestnut's autobiography is titled Black in Selma. I'm Terry Gross, and this is an archival edition of Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Monday, Fresh Air becomes part of National Public Radio's special programming on the war in the Gulf. Today's Fresh Air features an interview and a reading from our archives. Coming up, an interview with one of the many members of the Carradine family to take up acting as a career. Keith Carradine has starred in the movies Nashville, Pretty Baby, Trouble in Mind, and Choose Me. Also, we have a reading from poet Sharon Olds. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Sirens have been heard in Israel, where it's now early Friday morning. Israeli officials say that three missiles exploded in central Tel Aviv, and in Jerusalem, a police official confirms that there have been explosions on the road and in the air. A short time ago, NPR's Carol Ann Clark spoke with reporter Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Just explain to us what's happening.
I'm shaking. I'm a little bit scared. The siren just went off right now. I don't even know what time it is in here. Israelis have previously sealed off a room in their house against a chemical missile attack. The siren just went off now. I'm going to play a few seconds of it. Instructions for this are to go into the room that's been prepared and to put on the gas mask to attach the filter. Nobody's sure exactly what's happening, but I'm going to put on my gas mask until I find out what's going on.
Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem, and as we reported earlier, Israeli officials say that three missiles exploded in central Tel Aviv, and in Jerusalem, a police official confirms that there have been explosions on the road and in the air. On Capitol Hill today, lawmakers remained unified behind the president. Some partisan bickering did go on when Democrats and Republicans wrangled over the wording of a resolution of support for the Persian Gulf effort. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Many on Capitol Hill say that the debate last weekend over the resolution authorizing force was Congress at its best. Very little political posturing, a serious reasoned debate. But today, some of that high-mindedness seems to have evaporated. Democrats in the Senate wanted to introduce a resolution that would put Congress on record supporting the men and women of the armed forces. Republicans wanted the resolution to include language praising President Bush and his decision to deploy troops. Finally, after a day of passing drafts of the resolution back and forth, a compromise was struck and the Senate voted on and passed a resolution that says the Congress commends and supports the efforts and leadership of the president as commander-in-chief and unequivocally supports the men and women of our armed forces. Meanwhile, lawmakers from both houses are being briefed by defense officials, briefings that are expected to continue on a weekly basis for the duration of the war. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
In Turkey, lawmakers there have authorized the use of air bases in the country for U.S. planes to use for their attacks on Iraq. The vote in the parliament was 250 to 148. Opposition parties voted against the move, saying that it would drag Turkey into the war. Turkey is the only NATO country sharing a border with Iraq. Belgium has expelled 7 of the 9 Iraqi diplomats in that country for what was termed security reasons. In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials gained 115 points to close at 2,623.51 on volume of 319 million shares. Advancing issues led declines 5-1. This is NPR News. Jordan has condemned the U.S.-led airstrikes on Iraq and called them a brutal attack. Officials also said that all Royal Jordanian flights in and out of the country have been canceled, in effect closing all civilian airports in the country. The streets of Amman have been quiet, with many shops closed. Many residents taped their windows in the event that war breaks out between Iraq and Israel, and Jordan is caught in the middle. Last night, Jordan's King Hussein said that he would not allow Israel to cross his country's airspace in order to strike at Iraq. There is also a report that several journalists were attacked by pro-Iraqi Jordanians in Amman. British Prime Minister John Major addressed that country this evening, his first formal address since war began. From London, Michael Gofarb reports.
Saying, if you appease a bully, you pay for it later, the somber prime minister spoke for just over 7 minutes. This is the first crisis Major has faced since he replaced Margaret Thatcher as prime minister. He spoke only in general terms, going over the background leading up to the decision to go to war. Despite the apparent success of the first day's bombing, he did not suggest victory would be easy.
I will not offer you rash promises about how quickly this can be done. The operation on which we have embarked involves danger and sacrifice. But I am confident that it will succeed. And we know it is a battle which has to be fought. It is a just cause.
At no time did Major mention specifics about today's actions. For National Public Radio, this is Michael Goldfarb in London.
Fires broke out in three department stores in Bonn, Germany today, but officials there say that they have no evidence that they are in retaliation for air attacks on Iraq. Security forces in Germany have been put on full alert because of concern about possible attacks after those airstrikes. Trading in Europe, the dollar was sharply lower. I'm Ann Taylor, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Today's program features material from the Fresh Air Archives. Beginning Monday, Fresh Air will join National Public Radio's special programming on the war in the Gulf. The interview we're about to hear with Keith Carradine was recorded last fall. Keith Carradine belongs to a family of actors. His father is John Carradine, his older brother is David, his younger brother is Robert, and the actress Martha Plimpton is Keith's daughter. Keith Carradine has worked with a number of important directors. Robert Altman directed Carradine in Nashville and Thieves Like Us. Alan Rudolph directed him in Choose Me, Trouble in Mind, and The Moderns. And he starred in Louis Malle's film Pretty Baby. Carradine is the kind of actor who seems most at home in offbeat films, playing con men, artists, and womanizers.
I generally tend to choose roles that are going to take me out of myself. That's where I get off, as a craftsman. The further I can play from my own personality or my own lifestyle or anything like that, the more entertained I am in my work. My own life is basically, fairly middle class. I mean, I'm married, I got kids, I have all of the usual attendant concerns, problems, joys of that kind of life.
When you were growing up, how close were you to your father's acting career? How much of... Were you ever on the set with him? Were there a lot of acting friends over at the house? Did you feel like this was a big actor family?
Well, it was certainly, growing up with Pa was distinctive. He was, his personality was very colorful and forceful. But he did not really, I think he tried to keep his children away from being, backstage babies. The notion of having been born in a trunk, in the middle of some road company somewhere. He really wanted us to have normal childhoods. I went to a public school, until I was in senior high school. Then I went off to a boarding school, a prep school. But for the most part, I led a very normal life. He didn't take us on movie sets much.
Is that because you'd be a bother or because he wanted to just...
Well, I think he just wanted us to kept away from it. I think that he wanted us to have normal lives. And... I think that he was acutely aware of the influence that it might have on our later career choices if we spent too much time around his world. Maybe it was a reverse psychology, because he was certainly delighted that as many of his sons went into acting as did,
It's interesting. Your father, John Carradine, was a classical kind of actor, but he ended up doing zillions of horror films.
He had to make money. He was raising seven boys, which is not cheap.
So what stage of his career was he in during your formative years?
He was doing a lot of the crap when I was growing up. Yeah. He was not real happy about it. Occasionally he would get something that he could sort of enjoy. And once in a while he would mount a theater production and he'd go and do some classical or semi-classical character. And that would, that would renew his energy and his joy in what he, his chosen career. But most of the time he was bringing... unexpected luster to some pretty mediocre movies.
Let me just ask you, I know your father filed for bankruptcy during one point when you were growing up. How did that happen?
Well, he went off to Africa. He had his first really well-paying gig that he'd had in a while. We did not grow up rich.
Mm-hmm.
We grew up culturally rich in my household, but we didn't have a lot of money. And this was during a particularly lean time, and he got a big sort of plum role in this Tarzan movie, and he was getting some good money. And they went off and shot it in Africa. He was playing the heavy. The father of the bad guys. There were like three of them, the father and his two evil sons. Gordon Scott was the handsome, suntanned hero. And when he finished shooting in Africa, he had a stop in London on his way home. And he went into a casino, you know, during the night he was there and managed to gamble away not only his entire salary, but twice his entire salary. I think he might have been getting like $40,000 for the 8 weeks or something, which in those days was a lot of money. And I think he was $80,000 down at one point. And then he managed to get up to where he'd broken even. And by that time, it was 6 in the morning, and he left the casino and called my stepmother and told her he'd just gambled away in his entire paycheck. That was the beginning of an interesting phase.
What was the family reaction to this?
We moved.
To a cheaper place, right?
You bet. Well, that didn't strike me as terribly expensive, the place we were in, but I guess it was probably twice the rent. You know, we were living in this big old rambling house with horses, and it was kind of a ranch. And we went from that to a sort of a Cracker Box tract home. And we all crammed into there. And that was really what life was like for the next 5 to 8 years. That was how we lived. It was very middle class. And in terms of income, material wealth. And that's how it was. I would go after school. I remember we didn't live too far from where we had moved. And I used to get on my bicycle after school and ride over to the old house and just sort of sit there longingly wishing for a return to the good old days.
Right.
Yeah.
Keith Carradine is my guest. Your brother, David, had the same father but a different mother, so you're stepbrothers.
We're half-brothers.
Half-brothers, I mean, right.
Yes.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
So you grew up with your father and he grew up with his mother?
Yeah, once his mother and my father separated, David stayed with his mother, yeah.
So did you really know each other very well when you were
Not
growing up?
Not really. I mean, I kind of had passing acquaintances with David, who was then Jack. He was born John Arthur, and he was called Jack.
How did he change it to David?
Well, he became David somewhere in the early 60s, I think, at the beginning of his career, when some agent suggested that he go by some other moniker than the old man's name.
Right.
So I'm not even sure how he chose David, but anyhow, that's what he hung on himself. You know, our relationship was really passing. I sort of admired him from afar because he was always a very dynamic personality. And he would show up for family dinners and things on occasion, you know. And I was always very impressed with him, and I kind of looked up to him. Until finally, when I was striking out on my own, it was actually just before I got out of high school, I went down and looked him up. I was down on a weekend away from boarding school with a couple of friends, and we went down to Hollywood and stayed at one of my friends' homes. And we looked David up one night. And that was really kind of the beginning of our relationship as brothers. And he took me under his wing. When I finally moved down to Hollywood, I was struggling along. I was sharing an apartment with a buddy in Venice Beach, and we were cooking Colonel Sanders chicken for a living. Pretty squalid existence. But David came along and took me in and actually supported me for about 6 months. And guided me into my, you know, my initial, you know, halting steps as an actor.
Were you ever up for the same roles early on?
We still are on occasion.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's very bizarre. I mean, you wouldn't think we would ever be, but we were both up for Bound for Glory. We were both up for the role of Woody Guthrie.
He got it.
He got it. We were both up for the role in Pretty Baby. I got that one.
Oh, so,
you know,
really?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's interesting. There is great competition in this business. And to be in competition with your own family for the same part is kind of an odd thing, but it's a wonderful thing because if ever I was going to lose a part to somebody, I would certainly rather lose it to David than some guy that I don't know.
Right.
You know, we have great love for each other, and our competition is loving and supportive, you know, if there is any.
I have to ask you, you know his TV series, Kung Fu?
Yeah, I know that one.
Yeah. There's a shot of you, isn't there? You know, the
yes,
opening sequence?
Yes, I did the pilot.
Oh, okay.
I did the pilot, and I played the middle Kane. So I was supposed to be David at age, like, 18 or 20 or something like that.
Oh, that's you.
That's me.
You know where I recognize you? There's a shot in the opening sequence.
Yes.
In the temple, and you're one of the students, is that the right word?
That's right. Well, it's supposed to be sort of
with
a chronological...
A
it's supposed to be kind of a chronological documentation of the growth of this character. See, you see him as a young child, and you see him as a teenager, which is me, and then finally it's David, the full-fledged, full-blown grasshopper. But David invited me. He asked me to come do the pilot. I was already, you know, I was enjoying some wonderful success in my career at that point. And to me, it certainly wasn't something that I needed in terms of my career, but it was an opportunity to take part in a kind of, in some way a family project, you know. So they had me come over and I did the pilot. And then they used footage from that bit that I did for all the 3 years. They kept using that footage.
I see.
Every once in a while I'd get a check for $14, you know, from whatever network it was or whatever production company it was. Warner Brothers, I guess.
All right. Well, you did one movie with your brothers David and Robert.
Yeah.
And that was The Lone Riders, directed by Walter Hill. It's a wonderful film, and there's two other sets of brothers in it.
The Quaids. The Quaids, the Keaches, and the Guests.
That's right, the Guests, that's right.
Christopher Nicholas Guest, yeah.
Right. So was it fun to have three brothers in the same film?
It was a gas. I can't tell you how much fun it was. We had a ball. It was a kid's dream come true. Just to be able to get up every morning and put on a duster and a six gun and get on a horse and go out and ride and shoot and hoot and holler, you know. I mean, this and get paid for that? I mean, it's unbelievable. It was like summer camp. And it was just a wonderful group, and there was a great kind of energy and spirit to the whole endeavor. It was a 12-week shoot that went on for 16 weeks because of weather problems and other things. And, you know, when you get to the end of a 16-week shoot, ordinarily, you've had it. You cannot wait to get home, and you cannot wait to see the last of all those people you've been confronted with on a daily basis. But in this particular case, we were having so much fun that I don't think there's a man on that picture who wouldn't have gone on another 16 weeks gladly. I mean, mm-hmm. It was just a terrific experience.
We're listening to an interview with actor Keith Carradine. Today's edition of Fresh Air features interviews from our archives. Beginning Monday, Fresh Air will be part of National Public Radio's special programming on the war in the Gulf. More with Keith Carradine after this short break. This is Fresh Air. We're featuring an interview from our archives with actor Keith Carradine.
I think the first movie that you were really noticed in was Nashville.
Mm-hmm.
You played a real cad and then got to sing this really sensitive folk song, I'm Easy, which you wrote.
Yeah.
This is a movie where a lot of the actors were asked to write their own songs for it.
Mm-hmm.
That song won an Academy Award.
Yes.
And you recorded a couple albums and had a small career as a singer afterwards. How serious were you about your singing career then?
Well, I was serious about it. It was always a secondary pursuit of mine. The only reason I had a singing career was because of my movie career. The sales of my first record were quite wonderful because of the success of I'm Easy. My second record, which I thought was far superior artistically, didn't sell at all. And that was kind of disillusioning, you know.
How did you start working with Robert Altman?
I walked into his office when he was going to do McCabe and Mrs. Miller. And, you know, it's a part of this young cowboy who comes up to use the whorehouse in the town of Presbyterian Church. And David's then agent and manager, a fellow named Saul Krugman, who's now gone, knew about the project and knew about this role and thought I'd be very right for it. And he arranged for me to meet with initially the producers and then with Mr. Altman. And I had my hair was about 2 feet long when I met Bob. And I walked into his apartment office in Westwood. And it was one of the most bizarre meetings I've ever had. I wish they were all like that. Because usually they sit you down and they intimidate you and then they see how well you hold up, you know. But with Bob, it was just, it was so real, and it had nothing to do with any of that stuff. It had to do with just who you were and how you behaved, because that's the way he casts. He casts behavior. And he saw this kid walk into his office, and I think he probably knew within 15 or 20 seconds that he wanted me to play the part. But he was unwrapping this package that had been sent to him from Colombia. He'd been down there at the Cartagena Film Festival or something, and he came back with some pre-Columbian art, and he was unwrapping this parcel and showing it to me. I think, as I remember, it was a stone angel or something. And he said, well, we're going to do this movie up there. He says, I don't know about the hair. Well, maybe we can use it like it is. He says, it's not much of a part, but if you want to do it, you know, you want to do it? I said, well, yeah, sure. And that was it. I mean, there was no reading. There was no, you know, none of that stuff. He took a look at me and said, yeah, come on up.
There's another movie I want to ask you about. That's Pretty Baby, in which you played a photographer who's taken with a young girl who's growing up in a whorehouse and who becomes the photographer's model.
Yes.
And This was directed by Louis Malle.
Mm-hmm.
And so you played opposite the very young Brooke Shields. I mean, this is the role that launched her career. She was, what, 11 or 12?
She was 11 when we shot the picture. She turned 12 the last week of shooting.
What was it like working opposite the 11-year-old Brooke Shields? I mean, it was a very demanding role because she had to play very mature.
She had to play very mature, and which was to rationally approach an 11-year-old girl with romance on your mind is impossible. Coming from the place of being a 26-year-old man, which is what I was at that point. The trick that I had to do in my head in order to make that work was to, rather than try to bring her to my level, was to simply reduce myself to the emotional level and remember what it felt like when I was 11 and when I had a crush on a girl in school. And that was really what I had to become in order to play that part, was in terms of my relationship with her, I had to go to the emotional level of 11 or 12 years old and simply remember myself at that point. Otherwise, it would have been impossible. I couldn't have dealt with it.
That's an interesting way of handling it.
Mm-hmm. So it wasn't a man with a child. It was a boy with a child from the point of view of we were contemporaries.
Actor Keith Carradine. Today's edition of Fresh Air features material from our archives. This is Fresh Air. Sharon Olds is with us to read a poem. Writer David Levitt once described Sharon Olds as enormously self-aware. He said, her poetry is remarkable for its candor, its eroticism, and its power to move.
The poem I'm going to read is called The Bed. When I looked at it today on my way here, I thought, I wonder how many people think of poems as places where stories are told. The bed. My father's new wife was standing at the sink in their new apartment, her hands in the suds. She was looking out the window, down at the street. She saw a tall, dark-haired teenager turn the corner. That's his girl, she said to herself. She had never seen me, not even a picture. I hadn't called. She looked at me and knew me. In a minute, the bell rang, and there I stood on his long legs, under the shock of his dark hair. She let me in, fed me something. I stared at her. This was the woman my father loved. My father was in love. I ate and ate and gazed, till we heard his key in the lock. Surprise, surprise! He saw us standing together, flushed, blushing. In the heat of that moment, softened metals, we were joined. Even 30 years later, when we stood on either side of his bed, holding his hands, and he sank away out of the human, the bond did not break. We held to him the way you hold the last child and crack the whip, so he flies, feet off the ground, and the chain holds. That first day, we stood there, cheeks hot. Then my father led us over to a wall with a groove in it, like the outline of a doorway, a passage into some other world. He pushed a button, and down out of the wall fell a double bed. Its legs bounced on the floor. It danced while he laughed, their Murphy bed of love. In the night, he said, it would close suddenly, like a book slamming. They'd wake up upright, smashed against the wall, flies under the swatter. We stood and beamed at each other. After that, when I thought of them, I thought of their bed snapping shut like a mouse trap, throwing them against the wall in violent climax, something to grasp my father as hard as I'd wanted to clasp him, the two of them crushed together like flowers pressed in a book, so flat they're transparent, the stamen lolling over the pistil, the anther indented in the petal, the man and woman as God had made them, almost my parents in love.
Sharon Olds is the director of creative writing at NYU. Her latest collection of poems, The Gold Cell, is published by Knopf. Today's edition of Fresh Air featured material from our archives. Beginning Monday, Fresh Air will be part of National Public Radio's special programming on the war in the Gulf. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.